Hello, everybody. This is Randy Wooten, CEO of Maxio and your host of SaaS Expert Voices, the podcast where we talk to experts in and around SaaS about what's happening today and what they think is going to be happening tomorrow. I'm really excited to have Nathan Latka join us today. He is one of those influencers in the space that I've known for years. In fact, when I was at Percolate, we did an initial interview on his podcast when he was running the Latka agency. But he's had this incredible experience, primarily as an entrepreneur, which we'll talk a little bit about. It's been broken into three basic phases. From 2011, he started a variety of social media and social marketing companies and was super successful with his first startup. Then he moved into running the Latka agency, which we all probably have followed his reports that he publishes, a prolific publisher of information using data to inform entrepreneurs, and really one of the first people driving the media-led growth model and how do you create content and generate it, which is great to see. And then in 2020, he started his own fund. It's a debt financing fund, which we'll get into a little bit of detail of why he went debt versus VC. He's also an author and podcaster. He's a connector. He brings people together. He's a provocateur in terms of the ideas that he shares. And so it's just been great to get to know you over the years, Nathan. And thank you very much for joining our podcast.
No, Randy, it's certainly mutual. And congratulations on the merger and the rebrand and what you're doing at Maxio and your team to lead the space. So excited to jump in today.
Awesome. So we talked a little bit about your three chapters. Maybe give us a little bit of background. There you were, social media was blowing up and you jumped into that space. And then we can talk about, well, what led that to the Latka agency?
Yeah, I think taking a step back, my dad is a month older than my grandma. And so I grew up with parents that were 22 years apart. And that meant my dad was a coal miner, right? Grew up pinching pennies in Pennsylvania. My mom was a double entrepreneur and was the breadwinner. And so when I went and studied architecture at Virginia Tech in 2008, you know, in my back of my head, I always knew, I said, I want to make a lot of money so I can have financial freedom and do what I want with my life. I don't want to do what I'd done growing up, which is penny pinching. You know, I love my dad to death, but that's how he grew up. And so when I was in architecture at Virginia Tech in Southwest Virginia, and I heard fifth year students when I was a freshman saying, you know, we're graduating and we can't get a job. And I'm going, this is the third ranked program in the country. Why would I put myself through this for 5 years if I don't have a guaranteed job? And that's when I said, I've got to find another way. And I found this thing, Randy, called FBML, which was called Facebook Markup Language. It's the code you used to launch custom Facebook fan pages back in the day. And that was my first software company.
That's great. And so then how did you move? Well, first, any lessons learned? Because I had been in that social space as well. I had been CEO of Percolate, which was a social media marketing space. And just we talked about at that time that all of marketing was going to shift to the pace and pattern of social, meaning it was always on, real time, had to add value, thinking about rather than when I was at Microsoft, we'd have these campaign planning, which would take quarters. It was like you had to be reacting within 24 hours. Is there something about that experience in social media marketing that then led you to found the agency?
Well, I think a lot of the success we had at Heyo, that was the name of the software company, H-E-Y-O, we bootstrapped it to about $1 million run rate. And yes, obviously, I want to take credit for that, but we were also extraordinary lucky. I mean, Zuckerberg was on the cover of every magazine, Facebook was blowing up, and we just happened to capture some of that momentum and it generated revenue for us. But in the back of my head, you're always going, this is not my platform. We are dependent on somebody else. What is the real moat we're building here? And so ultimately, I said, well, if I want to build something special and really build additional moat, we should probably, you know, raise capital. And I say, you know, VC dollars is some of the best marketed, maybe the best marketed money in the world, because you're sort of convinced that if you don't raise VC, you maybe don't have a real or a, you know, a unicorn software company. So anyways, I raised $2 million on a 8.5 pre-money valuation, 10.5 post. And the big lesson from this period of my life, Randy, was when I got a $6.5 million acquisition offer from Ryan Allison iContact to sell the company after that VC round. You've been around the block. You know how my board responded. What'd they say?
They said, well, we're not going to clear the pref stack.
Exactly. Right. If you can't sell for 6.5, if you just raised a 10.5 post, but in my head, I'm going, I'm 21 years old. I'd love to take home 3 million post tax. What are you talking about? I can't sell the company. And this is where, you know, you learn the hard way. Thankfully, I learned it early, but I said, you know, let me sell the company. It wasn't a massive win. Okay. But we got the deal done. So I could say I'd sold a company, and then said, I just need to learn. And that's when I got into Lack Agency, launched the podcast. The intent there was to interview founders and learn as much as I possibly could before launching my next business.
Well, that's great. And I do think as someone, I've only been VC. Well, I guess my first CEO gig was public company. So it had already gone out. I joined them after they were public. And so managing public company shareholders, really different than managing a board of VCs who are coming in at different stages. And my last company, Percolate, we had Sequoia, GGV, Lightspeed, First Round Capital.
How much did you guys raise at Percolate?
Oh, gosh. Well, they had raised a bunch before I showed up. I think it was north of $70 million. And we were upside down. And we eventually sold the company. But to your point, like as a CEO, professional CEO coming in, my intention was to certainly create shareholder value. But number two was to land the tech, to land the customers and land the people and have it be a successful transaction in terms of best possible outcomes. So I think the VC model, to your point, so few people get invested in terms of total companies that actually have VC investment. I think it's like less than 1% of all software companies or something. So there's an enormous amount of successful private companies out there. But to your point, like the VC and getting funded by VC is, people think it's like ringing the bell. And if they don't have the experience that you've had or that you're sharing on your podcast about how to structure the deal, they can give up a lot of equity or set expectations at super high valuation that they got to grow into and just becomes an issue. Okay. And so then Laka, you were doing, how many folks did you interview on through your podcast?
Yeah. So we got the podcast going. The first episode went live in August of 2017. The intent was to do, a couple per month, but I sort of fell in love. For anyone listening, thinking about launching a podcast for your SaaS company as a media moat, something to consider is you have to think about it like a long-term game. You've got to say, would I publish one episode per week for 3 years with no listeners and still enjoy the process? And if the answer is no, don't even start. It's not worth it, right? Now, if you create and do it consistently and create habitual habits with your listeners over time, it becomes a massive asset, which is, Randy, probably why you guys are at Nadine are making the investments you're making at Maxio, but it's a long-term play. And so we've interviewed now today. Personally, I've interviewed over 3,300 B2B SaaS CEOs.
Wow. That's incredible. Yeah, I think there is something about, do you like to have conversations? That's been the upside for me personally was, we've probably done 30 so far, but every person I've interviewed, really interesting, have great stories, and I've enjoyed it. And so to your point, whether or not we're getting the downloads that we would like, not yet. I think we're in the top 50% of all podcasts, but there's a super long tail of people doing podcasts. Yeah. So trying to figure out the sweet spot in terms of guest and content and promotion is really interesting. Okay. And so then the Laka Agency, you did that for a bit. You, to your point, you interviewed a bunch of people to learn all those lessons. After 3,300 interviews, I imagine you had a lot of pattern matching, which we'll get to in a second. But then you decided to start your own fund, a debt financing fund, this founder path. Talk a little bit about what the genesis of that was and why you went debt versus VC. You alluded a little bit earlier to that, but I think it's a really interesting point.
When I was building Heyo back when I was, 21, 22, I thought that everyone who built a software company raised money. I thought that that was the path, that was the option.
Yep.
I didn't realize that there is a waste management software in Southwest Kentucky that's not on Crunchbase, that the Wall Street Journal has never featured, and that Sequoia doesn't even know about, that's doing $6 million of ARR, profiting $2 million of cash flow every year. But I experienced those stories over time on the podcast and realized for about every one that had raised equity or raised VC, there was about 900. It's like a 1 to 1,000 ratio, like 999 that were happy, profitable, not super fast growing, but very happy founders, profitable $5 million software companies. And so what I said at that moment was, and this happened really in 2018 timeframe, is it shouldn't be binary. Like you can't access capital markets unless you're a SaaS company growing 300% year over year and go raise VC, right? And the SVBs of the world, they're doing sort of sponsor-backed lending. They want to see you raise $20 million from Sequoia. Then they give you $5 million because they're banking on the deposits.
Right.
That's not actually underwriting the software company, right? Retention, churn, ARPU, CAC, LTV, right? And so what we said is, man, I bet I could lend to some of these companies and actually underwrite the business, not the equity sponsor. And that will create an opportunity for these companies that never want to raise VC to get some cash to grow a little faster or run an experiment or hire an engineer. And so Randy, that was a long answer, but in 2018, I started writing personal checks for about $10K, doing very small debt deals with software companies.
Oh, great. Yeah. Right on.
And so it's raised a small fund.
That's great. So that idea of venture debt versus the debt that you're like ARR debt or revenue-based financing, I've heard it called. We actually, most of our customers at Maxio, we have about 2,400 customers. Most of them are venture or PE-backed. And we've explored this idea of, gosh, we have the invoicing and billing data. So the risk of the analysis that a bank or someone like you and your company would need to do is very different than if someone was just showing up. Because one, you got all the history of the data. And then number two is you can get right in the flow. And to be perfectly honest, we've worked with some other partners in this revenue-based finance space. And our customers currently haven't seen us as a channel to get access to debt. Like they want that from their bank. And then we're going off a little off script here. How do you find those people? Clearly, you have 3,300 people that you've interviewed and you got this huge network. And is that what you're doing, is just building on that CRM to go out and say, here's a new value prop, debt financing, control your own fate, don't get caught in the VC gauntlet?
Yeah. I mean, what I would say is it depends. Like some founders, they understand the VC game and they want to go play that game. And I say, go for it. We'll promote the heck out of you. We wish you luck. Godspeed. Others know they don't want to go that path, right? But I think what I spend a lot of time doing is once I realized debt was an option in 2018, I started asking about it in the interviews to learn more. Mm-hmm. So I'd ask VC-funded companies, hey, how do you think about debt? And what they would tell me is, well, we couldn't really access debt until we did our Series D for $100 million and Goldman did a $50 million term loan at, you know, SOFR plus 200, or back then LIBOR plus 200 bips, right? So like a 6% interest rate with 2% warrants on a 6-year term with a 24-month IO or a bullet at the end. And I'm like, okay, that's all fine, but what if someone doesn't want to raise the Series D at all in the first place?
Right.
Who's going to back them? And then I went in and I did a lot of research on Lighter Capital. I thought what they built was interesting.
Right.
But you paid Lighter Capital back, you know, 4-9% of gross monthly receipts. So you never quite knew what your payment was going to be. It was kind of confusing. And if you grew quickly, you'd pay Lighter back faster. So your effective interest rate was higher. That didn't make sense to me. I loved what SaaS Capital was doing because this is a compliment in the lending space. They're really boring and it's perfect. They're never going to go out of business for lending to bad credits.
Correct.
Like, I mean, you look at what has happened at, you know, Pipe. They really spent a lot of money educating the space about what revenue-based financing was 2-3 years ago, but the founders are not there anymore because they had a lot of losses. Like, so SaaS Capital had a great model, but when I looked at SaaS Capital and said, should I get into debt? Can I offer something different than SaaS Capital? You know, they really weren't even taking phone calls unless you had a minimum of $3 or $5 million of ARR.
Right.
Right. Because Steve and the team over there, they're great, but it's a 10-person team.
Right.
And there's not a lot of tech. They have to pick big deals to do. They have limited time. And so the sweet spot I identified was, can we automate underwriting for founders with 1 to 3 million of ARR and enable them to get $500K to $1 million factoring their receivables? And that's when we launched FounderPath and the larger fund in 2020 and 2021.
Well, congratulations. I mean, clearly you did it just the way entrepreneurs do, is you go interview a bunch of people, you find out if there's a sweet spot, a pain that's not been satisfied, you segment your audience, your ICP very specifically, and then you offer value that other people aren't able to deliver. So congratulations. And this is your third fund that you're now offering through FounderPath.
Yeah, first one was $5 million before even FounderPath. It was really hard to manage all the borrowers. So I said, here's founderpath.com, connect your API so we can monitor automatically. That was the launch of FounderPath. And then in 2022, we raised our second fund, which is $150 million fund. And that's what we're currently investing out of today.
Got it. Awesome. All right. Well, let's thank you very much. What a great career and congratulations for success. And I wish you continued success. And maybe there's a way we can partner and figure out how to offer some of your debt services to some of our customers.
I just have to give you guys a shout out real quick. You know, we work with a lot of partners and a lot of times API endpoints are messy and it's really hard to work with, but we have a lot of founders that have connected their Maxio accounts. Your API endpoints are very easy to read. So credit to your engineering team and your API team there, but we've underwritten and wired money to many Maxio customers because their data was clean, right? They use your MRR waterfall. They use your templates. It's beautiful and easy for us to underwrite because you guys help them keep things clean.
Well, that's great, Nathan. Thank you. That was unsolicited, but appreciate it. That's what we talked. Well, part of the reason I came here was because it's investor grade reports. And it's we talk about people getting funded, stay funded. What's interesting, I hadn't thought broadly about, well, we had because we were looking at the revenue-based finance, but we should chat more about how we can broaden the definition of what it means to get funded, right? How do you get capital to go do what you want to do? I'd love to shift. We're going to talk about a couple of things. One is what's happening in the broader startup market today. And then number two, we'll talk about what does it mean to be successful as a CEO, and then we'll see how it goes from there. But you've talked to 3,300 customers or entrepreneurs and more through all the other events that I've seen you at and been with you at. What are you seeing in the startup market in terms of how things have changed over the last 2 years? Everyone talks about growth at all costs versus efficient growth. I mean, we don't need to spend a lot of time on that, but just like double click down for us. What's the insight that you have that isn't being talked about broadly in the marketplace because the people are only staying at the surface level of, hey, you got to be efficient growth, not grow at all costs?
Yeah. I mean, look, I'm only 34, so I don't have the benefit of 40 years of experience or history. But if we expand a little bit longer duration than just the past 2 years, and maybe look at the last 5 years,
sure.
You know, you used to be able to back 5 years ago at my first software company, we could buy attention. We knew what we could spend on an ad to get the sign up, to get the trial, to convert. You then, I don't know if my dates are exactly right here, but in 2017, 2018, you know, Jeff Katzenberg, billionaire, very successful with Meg Whitman, right? Ex-eBay, I mean, top tech CEO. They got together, if you remember, and created with a lot of hype this thing called Quibi, which they wanted to launch and go after the streaming wars, compete with Disney Plus, Netflix. They spent billions, Randy, right? Trying to buy attention. They launched, it failed, it went out of business. They shut it down. Billions were lost. The lesson there is you cannot buy attention anymore. Doesn't matter how much money you have. If you are a bootstrapped founder competing against a VC-backed competitor and they're trying to buy attention, but you're more creative and you have figured out to get the attention of your customers in a creative way, you will win long term. It's just a matter of time. So that is, I would say, if you force me to only articulate one sea change over the past 5 years, it would be that you must earn attention today with media-led growth. You cannot buy it.
That's great. I think a couple of points on that. One is just there's been, well, with SaaS growing, there's been an enormous number of companies been funded, right? With all that VC money we were talking about before, they're all spending money on trying to buy attention, buying keywords, but they're not saying anything different. And so when you look at their websites, you can often take the logo and just put it from one to the other. I saw this in the marketing MarTech space specifically, and there was something like 20,000 MarTech vendors. And that guy, Chief MarTech, that just every year does the scary as hell if you're in MarTech. And so I got out of MarTech and went to the CFO, the office of the CFO, to play in that space. And one of the things, the plays that we're doing is the Maxio Institute. And the Maxio Institute is we take the 2,400 customers, we go through the data because we have the billing and invoicing data, and we publish a report every quarter. And other than surveys, which are people fill out surveys, we are one of the few that has the actual data and are able to do that. And so to your point, how do you build a foundation around thought leadership, around differentiated data, which is what you did at the LACT agency in particular. And I see you continue to publish, hey, what's the top 250 software companies and what size are they? And it's just continuing to provide insights into data that no one else has.
Yeah, I mean, that was autos also because I got podcast listeners in 2019 that said, Nathan, you've recorded 600 episodes at that point. Which one should I start with? And I said, well, what do you care about? And they said, well, I want to listen to someone with 5 million in revenue. I said, oh, I have to categorize all these on GitLaka.com so people can sort by revenue
or
profitability. And that's how GitLaka.com got going. And then we started selling subscriptions to that data set. Think of it like a mini PitchBook or Crunchbase for B2B SaaS. And you know, it doesn't do, you know, $10 million of revenue, but I can tell you it does in the millions of revenue. And we've brought in a great CEO, the ex-CEO of Datanize, who bootstrapped to 5 million and sold to ZoomInfo. And Ilya Simon is now doing a great job leading GitLaka.com, which includes the podcast, the magazine, and some of the media entities that you've mentioned.
That's great. Well, I'm not the first person to say this, but data is the new gold, right?
Yeah.
If you, and I think if you're just an application layer without having being really a system of record, you're going to struggle because someone is going to have access to the data. They're going to be able to aggregate it. And then this next, maybe this is the other trend, just speak to a little bit is AI, is it real or is it hype? I was CEO of a first CEO company, was a public company, first generation AI, and it was the real deal. And what we're seeing similarly is if you don't have the data, the source data, you're not going to be able to put the intelligence layer on top of it to create real differentiation. How about you? What are you seeing in terms of the hype around AI in the startup marketplace writ large?
Yeah, I mean, look, you look at Jensen and NVIDIA yesterday, and the stock price pop after the earnings call is incredible, right? But, you know, ultimately what AI is about producing intelligence,
right,
and making it available faster. And so that's what I like to think about, right? For our own company, I say at FounderPath, how can we produce intelligence faster? And that, if that means training an LLM, wonderful. Then it's like, okay, do we use Llama? Do we use OpenAI? Like, what do we use for that kind of stuff? Mm-hmm. You guys, I imagine, are doing the same kind of thing because you sit on a very unique data set, right? And it's like, how do you produce intelligence at scale for your user base? Typically, we tend to do this by having like growth advisors, right? People that have to find patterns and get on a call and coach founders or vice versa. And so there are going to be ways where you and I, Maxio and FounderPath, can figure out how to build some of this, actually, this intelligence. We can produce it inside of our applications with no calls at all. And I think that's where we're spending most of our time.
That's great. We are as well. I would say, having been down this path before, getting the data right and getting it in the right structure is a huge lift. And if it hasn't been designed in terms of making itself available for AI to process it, it's a big lift to go back and restructure your database. And so I think a lot of the companies that are starting today AI first are thinking about, okay, how do we shard our database? How do we create vector database? You know, there's a whole database strategy that if you were a web-based application, you may not be thinking about. But I think probably VCs and others are really looking for what's your data strategy and your AI strategy for the companies that are funding these days.
Yeah, you nailed it. I mean, if you talk to OpenAI, the app where it's the voice interface, and you say, what is the churn rate of ZoomInfo? Name any publicly traded company. And it's going to say, tell you churn is 6%. And you say, well, is that logo churn or revenue churn? Is that gross or net? It's going to go, oh, I don't understand your response. Please go read the SEC filing. You know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, this is the kind of thing where, like, at Maxio, I'm sure you deal with this a lot. We deal with a ton at FounderPath. When we are trying to ingest data to underwrite, we've got to get everyone to use our definition,
right,
or our four definitions of churn, and categorize it appropriately. Otherwise, it doesn't matter how good your AI is because you've trained the LM the wrong way on bad data.
Right. Amen. I think that was one of the reasons why I was excited about to come to this company. I mean, gap, right? Gap's defined. Yeah. You have an argument around, do you put, what part of customer success do you put above the line and below the line? Like, that's the excitement and gap. Other than that, it's done, right? You're just ensuring that you're closing the books. I mean, side point, I do think there will be a day powered by AI that companies will be able to close a 0-day close. And so you wrap the month, the next day you have your GAAP financial statements done. That's going to be through accounting software. But when you think about the world of ARR and then the metrics, the SaaS operating metrics, it's the Wild Wild West. And to your point, people have different ways of defining things. And we're trying to come out with a metric policy to say, hey, here's how it's done standard across the industry. So if you want to get funded, you need to be doing it this way. What we find is often early stage companies have their uncle doing their books and they're reading articles and they think they got the rev rec done right. And they're like, no, we want to do it this way. And until they get really often at that stage, they're using a CPA or a client advisory service, a fractional CFO, someone who really knows SaaS to come in and say, no, you're not doing rev rec correctly. Their ARR is all over the place. And so to your point, when you're trying to fund someone, understanding truly what is contracted ARR versus live ARR. And if you're contracting ARR because you gave first 6 months away for free, like, it creates confusion and noise in terms of how you're representing your business. And so I imagine that makes it hard for folks like you. And if you're trying to aggregate that and try and provide intelligence on top of it.
You nailed it.
Well, awesome. Well, let's shift to the next topic, which is around, hey, in this crazy world, lots of things changing, moving super fast. What's required to be a successful CEO? I've been writing the 7 Secrets of Success for CEOs. I would say my bias is I come in at companies that are Series C. So I've not been like you, an entrepreneur and founder. And so maybe if you wouldn't mind just talking a little bit about the distinction you would draw between founder and CEO, what makes a founder successful? And then as they make that transition to CEO, what do you think are the things that they need to be thinking about through that transition?
I mean, look, I don't have a lot of experience moving past the founder-led CEO into just the CEO sort of role. But in my head, the way I sort of think about it based off the interviews I've done is somebody like Randy Wooten is coming in because you are dealing with things that are, you know, the founder's got a vision. The CEO is about operating. Yeah. Right. These are the people. These are the teams. There's the budget. Here's the P&L. Here's the board deck and the founder's vision. That's sort of how I think about it. So the second that the vision isn't sort of carrying the whole business, you know, a lot of founders can get up to 10, 20, 30 million bucks just on vision. Right.
Right.
But at some point, you've got to start operating the business. And I think that's when it makes sense. We're using the word CEO, but you could also keep the founder CEO and hire a president, right?
Correct.
And there's a lot of ways to structure it, but
right.
I think that's the biggest difference. Would you disagree?
No, I think you're spot on. Sometimes people will split it between startup and scale up. So if you're thinking in terms, and this is what I think I bring to the table is, hey, how do you run operations at scale globally? How do you build efficiency, operate and execute? I think to your point, there can be startup CEO, clearly there are a bunch that have gone through and made a crap load of money. But I think part of it is often in B2B SaaS, the startup founder is technical. And so they have a vision for the problem they're trying to solve and the technical solution. They're doing evangelist sales, but at some point to go build the go-to-market motion in terms of how do you think about crystallizing the positioning and messaging when it's just not you selling it. So it's not one-to-one you're not playing tennis and instead you're playing, I don't know what the metaphor is, but you're, you know, you got to go reach 100 people. How do you scale your go-to-market? And then I think the other thing is sometimes technical founders tend to be like, well, the product works, people should just like it. And so then you got to install your customer success as a buffer between the reality of the product and the promise. Like those different components, I think is where you can get a scale-up CEO or president to your point, or COO. Yeah, it can add a lot of value. I think you find that with Sheryl Sandberg, you find that with Eric Schmidt, you find that at other companies as well, where the founding CEOs and founders have said, well, we need someone to come in and help operate. So I think that's great. Well, maybe then just focusing on that founder, that startup CEO, what have you found to be the three or four characteristics that, of all the people you've talked to that are consistent of not ensure success, but the most successful ones embody?
Yeah, I mean, they have to have a vision about what they believe about the future that other people don't believe, right? Otherwise, everyone else would be doing it and competition would drive out all the profit margin, right? So they've got to have something like that they believe in. Now, the question is, how do you get to something you believe in that you think the market doesn't see yet? Well, usually that comes from you're eating your own dog food. You know, you used to go cut lawns and you hated the software you use. Now you have and launched lawn cutting software, right? Or a marketplace to cut lawn, right? So I always look for what I call, especially in the world where attention wins, the founders that are best at getting attention is where they're telling their own story. Right. Because the market goes, of course, they understand the problem the best. They came from lawn cutting. I look for a vision about the future and I look for the founder market fit, not product market fit, the founder market fit and the founder's story fit to the market, right? And then those are, I think, two key ingredients.
That's great. In fact, about lawn mowing, I'm in this group, this Vistage group, which is a collection of CEOs. And there's a guy who started a company called Electric Sheep. He was he used to cut lawns. And this is now a robotic lawn cutting tool that they've launched to do commercial lawn landscaping. And it came from out of his experience, but also with his background, because he had studied robotics and had a couple, and he brought those two things together. So I love that idea of founder market fit. And then similar, that was your story as well in terms of how you got to where you were. And so that's awesome. So founder market fit. What about, I was alluding to this a little bit in joining Vistage. You know, one of the hardest things about a CEO at any stage is it's a really lonely job. So I talk about building your tribe and having a mentor, a coach, a peer group, and then also just your own advisory board of people who've known you for 15 years, can call out your own BS. What have you found successful founders have done in terms of building their tribe? Because sometimes it could be, I don't need anybody else. I got this vision. I'm totally convinced this is right. And if I talk to other people, they're going to slow me down. Versus, oh, no, I'd like to get mentors. I'd like to get coaches. Like, what are you seeing is most successful for the folks that you've talked to?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two kinds of founders here. They're the founders that sort of read and are consumers of intellect all day long, and they're terrible at taking action. I would much prefer the founder that takes action quickly and learns from first person versus just reads all day. You see what I'm saying? So
yeah.
My priority would always be the action-taking CEO first. And then it would be, okay, they've taken action to 10 million of ARR or 5 million of ARR. How can they or me or I or them build out a group around them so that as they make additional bets in the future, they can be better informed bets, but not compromise speed. And so that's why I've tried to surround myself with at Founder Path. You know, I've got people that they know me personally. So my first angel investor at Heyo, he's very close to me. So he knows how and when I overreact or when I don't react tough enough or the kinds of people I worked well with. So he's who I go to for that kind of stuff. There's others, you know, like our Series A lead, Savneet Singh, that has been around debt and finance for a long period of time. So anything related to warehousing or margins or macro or micro or alpha and beta, risk reward, you know, underwriting policies, I'm going to somebody like him. And so you sort of have your mini tribes based off what you think like you're, you know, weak at or strong at or what you need for the future. And that's how I've done it at Heyo. I mean, at Founder Path today.
That's great. One of the values that VCs sell, in addition to giving you capital, is the expertise and experience. And by being on the board, they're going to help you be more successful. I think it depends on who the VC is and what the relevant experience is. It depends on whether the partner who sold the deal actually shows up on the board or they give it to one of the people on the team. Bootstrapping your own company or taking debt financing, you don't have to have a board. You don't have to have... or at least a board with fiduciary responsibility because you're not playing with their money. Do you have a regular board that you set up in terms of an advisory board and you're coming in and sharing your results? Or is it more the model that you were hinting at where you're, if you have a specific issue, you go to an individual that you know is an expert to address versus having a regular board meeting in the discipline that a board meeting then entails?
I think cadence is valuable, but any founder that has no board that finds it hard to get motivated to look at their financials and close them out every quarter to know how they're doing is not going to be successful long term.
Right?
Now, you can put a board in place to put pressure on you to close it out and put the report out every quarter. But I mean, I do that myself. And a lot of our best bootstrap founders, they do this themselves and their board is their top six customers, which is the best board, you know? Hmm. So I think there's a variety of ways to do it. You know, I can also tell you horror stories. I mean, I won't name them, but I mean, there are many VC-backed companies where, you know, if a VC has 100 investments and you're not in the top five,
right,
that board member's not paying attention to your board meeting. They're not reading the deck ahead of time. They might even be working on replacing you.
Right.
Right. So, you know, I know there are some very valuable VCs, but they're usually investing all their time in their big winners. And that's usually, you know, less than 5-10% of their portfolio.
But, amen. I think some people talk about the A company, B company, and C company. And the A company is the one where they're going to make the return for the fund and they're investing energy and effort. The B companies are kind of like, well, I'll come to the board meeting and we'll see how it plays out. The C companies, they're actively thinking about either replacing the CEO, and that's where someone like me comes in, or what are they going to do? And they're just, because they're on 8-10 boards, it's hard to spend time. And I do think that the VC model is big returns for few investments. The challenge is a CEO and the portfolio is you only got that one investment. You're that one company, right? And if you've dropped from A to B and you're on the threshold of C, it can become really unnerving. And you're like, wait, this is when I actually really need you, is to come in and, you know, bring all that experience to bear and help me, you know, turn the ship. So I think that's great. In terms of thinking about who do you bring in, I am actually on two boards right now outside of the Maxio. One is Opal, which is content marketing. And so I had been in content marketing at Percolate. They're VC-backed, Madrona-backed, and Excel, I think. Great board members. And because I have background experience, I'm kind of like the independent for them.
Yep.
The other one I'm on is a private company, Guidant Financial, which provides funding for people who want to use their 401k and buy a franchise or something, getting early, really early. I should put you guys in touch. There might be an interesting overlap in your ICP. Anywho, they don't have invested capital, so it's just them running it. And so the board meeting is more of what we were just describing of, hey, we're coming in, we'll read the deck and we'll help you think through things. But at the end of the day, Jeremy, the CEO, has complete control. And so he can say, eh, interesting idea, but I'm going to go do X. You're like, good luck.
Yep.
So very different. Well, great. Well, why don't we shift to kind of the last deep dive topic, and then we'll go to the speed round around disruptions in the office of the CFO. Do you have, of all the companies you're talking to, people that are going after the office of the CFO, or of all the CFOs you've talked to, or controllers, maybe agencies or CPA firms that are supporting the entrepreneurs that you're working with, what are you seeing more broadly in that space?
I think the biggest misconception that founders who it's only their first or second company and they've never gotten above 5 or 10 million of revenue, the biggest misconception those founders have about what a CFO does is they think a CFO is just logging into QuickBooks or Maxio all day long and just closing the monthly books. But let me point out some examples to you. Giles Palmer, when he was running Brandwatch, acquired BuzzSumo for, you know, for $15 million cash. It was doing $5 million of revenue, right? 3x multiple. A year and a half later, or slightly after that, he sold the company for a 5x multiple. There's a 2x multiple arbitrage. That is financial engineering. That is inorganic growth. That goes through the office of the CFO, right? So these founders that sort of look at a CFO role as sort of bean counters are missing out on a massive opportunity. In fact, they're not even being exposed to opportunities to drive inorganic growth. And when you look at the most successful software companies today, they all have some component of inorganic growth. If you look at a publicly traded company that most of you haven't heard of called PAR Technologies, which competes with Square, they're IoT plus SaaS. So they put the hardware in the restaurant and then they sell the software to the restaurant. Well, Savneet just bought for $400 million of cash and equity, a combined entities doing $80 million top line, right? And $20 million of profits. He's trading though at a multiple higher than $80 million into $400 million.
Right.
So that is multiple arbitrage. That is inorganic growth. And if you can figure out an M&A strategy where you're either buying very similar products, but maybe instead of selling, you know, at an SMB level of $1,000 per year or less, you're now maybe you bought in your same space, but you bought a sales motion. You bought a same tool in your space, but they sell to the enterprise. That's an M&A strategy. Another one might be you look at like Freshworks, right? They've got thousands, tens of thousands of SMBs using them. If they buy one other tool and upsell it across 10% of the base, they just added $30 million of ARR, right? That's ARPU expansion kind of acquisition. This kind of stuff all flows through the office of the CFO.
Yeah. Well, great examples. I think that was spot on in terms of thinking about organic growth is what's coming from your current product in your current segment. And I think for founders, they're starting with here's the problem, the ICP and the persona we're going to go after. As they start to think about how to expand those customers, what are the other set of products you could be selling in? Well, you could build those, or to your point, you can do an inorganic play. You can go buy a company. I think then it's, well, how do you go buy that company? How do you get the funding? Do you self-fund it out of your own EBITDA? Or this is what the PE promises. Hey, we're going to go put money in. We're going to build the platform, drive efficiencies, use the EBITDA, and then also give you additional capital to go buy that inorganic growth that's going to lead to either ARR arbitrage or EBITDA multiples over time. I would say that has been my biggest lesson learned coming into a PE-backed mashup. Maxio was the integration of two companies, SaaS Optics and Chargeify, who each been around for about 12 years. We put them together, try to create a platform. We start offering new modules. But the growth assumptions that I talk with the board are, okay, so what's the organic growth going to be? And then who are you going to go out and buy? And how does that plug in? And so it is a continual conversation. And to your point, it is in large part driven by a CFO being able to say, okay, well, this is what we need the shape of the business to be able to support that. What are we going to invest in organic growth versus how are we going to optimize EBITDA? And then the other point that you mentioned, I think on the financial engineering is spot on, right? How do you create...
I was going to say, when I grew up too, like I always watched TVs and you see on my books behind me, I'm reading bios of these big M&A deals and you sort of are trained to think as a founder, whoa, I can't think about M&A until I'm like, have a PE firm behind me and I've got $100 million of revenue and then I can go to, I mean, I know there are companies that signed up to Founderpath with $1 million of ARR and we gave them capital, right? Non-dilutive. They used it to go buy other companies for like $500K cash and $500K stock. Right, and they double their revenue. I mean, inorganic growth is not something that is reserved only for $50 million ARR founders with a private equity backer.
That, great insight. And I think that's clearly one of the values that you offer with the access to capital you're providing. I think the other point you were making, which I, part of the reason why I came to this company was the CFO moving from back office to front office. So moving from closing the books and compliance to being able to have a seat at the table with the CEO and the CRO to define what our monetization strategy is going to be. So what are the pricing and packaging we're going to roll out? How is that hitting in terms of win rates? How is it impacting churn? And that is all that data is coming from the office of the CFO. And so they can be much more, rather than just cash management, they can really help you figure out, okay, what's your growth management? And so moving into that front office seat. With people that you work with, though, when do you find that they hire a CFO? Because my experience has been it takes getting to about 30 employees. Prior to that, you're probably doing it on QuickBooks. You're doing cash accounting. Is there an inflection point that you're finding when a bootstrapped CEOs are bringing a controller on board or a fractional CFO?
Yeah, I mean, look, this is a big deal. I mean, there are companies that I still battle with in our portfolio every day that are doing $6 million of revenue with no full-time finance person. Ooh. Like, that's too late. You should have a full-time finance person at that point, right? Yeah. You don't need to pay a $250,000 per year CFO if you're $1 million of revenue, right? So there's a bunch of really great firms. I'm sure you work with a bunch as partners, but you look at a Tebow Partners, Ben Murray at SaaS CFO, Escalon Partners. There's a bunch of these fractional CFO firms that you can pay somewhere between 50 and 150 per hour or 2 to 4K per month to do basic things like QuickBooks, general ledger management, some FP&A, stuff like that, the non-strategic stuff. But eventually, once you get up to, I think, $3, $4, $5 million bucks of revenue, you should have in your fixed headcount expenses a budget for a 150 to 250K per year full-time CFO.
Yeah, agreed. I think that's probably the right inflection point. And there are a bunch of these folks, these fractional CFOs. I would say the key is to find a firm that focuses on your industry. So there are very few CPA firms that are working with B2B SaaS, right? Yep. There are some out there,
What are your top three?
Yeah, the ones that I'm, these are the partners we're closest with is Countsy, Cruise, both West Coast. And so a lot of their portfolio comes from VCs and PEs. FRC is a great one. Naval Academy grad, shout out to Finstrat, a guy named Christian, I really have enjoyed getting to know because he came up through finance. He wasn't a CPA. And he has some startup experience. So his whole starting point is he goes to the entrepreneur and says, what is your end? What do you want to try to achieve? You got to be honest. Like, how much do you want to sell this for? Do you want to run it as lifestyle business? And then you do the 3-year backup and say, okay, well, then this is what needs to be true about the business and how you shape it. So he's adding the services at the highest level in terms of being a kind of financial advisor, financial engineer, as well as providing the accounting service. You can always get a CPA, but I think your point about bringing a CFO on board, they start to, finance becomes strategic.
Yep.
It's not just about closing the books. It's like, how are we going to run this business? How are we going to grow this business? And what's the exit, especially for people that are doing bootstrap? Because you don't have the VC saying, hey, this is our expectations into T2, D3, right? If you're not on track, we're going to do something else. This is you figuring out, well, do I want to create generational wealth? Am I just trying to buy an RV and retire with my wife? Like, it's, but getting honest about that then changes how you run your business.
Yep, you nailed it. And scenario analysis, right? It's really hard to run scenario analysis quickly without a full-time like model and someone owning and maintaining that model with actuals and historicals and go forward.
Awesome. All right, well, we're right at the towards the end of our conversation. Let's wrap up with the speed round. So three questions for you. And we can keep it short. One is favorite metric and why?
A payback period. Anyone that can get the money back instantly has the highest money velocity and short payback period is much better than a big LTV to CAC ratio.
Awesome. Specifically CAC payback or versus gross margin payback. Or do you have a
CAC? Exactly. You could do gross margin. Actually, that's even more conservative, but yeah, CAC payback.
Yeah. I was talking to a guy who runs a firm, actually Targus, Alex, on a podcast. He's a great one of these financial advisor, fractional CFOs, and he does gross margin payback. And that's the first time I had heard that because I've always been in the CAC payback world, but yeah, that's
well,
true.
Yeah. And the gross margin, just for anyone that wants to calculate themselves without spending much money, you're taking your monthly ARPU times your margin, right? So if you're selling something for $100 a month and you have 85% margin, you have $85 per month, divide that into your CAC of 160 of a 2-month gross margin CAC payback.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I thought it was a great new one that I hadn't known that much about. Favorite book? Doesn't have to be a business book, but if you got a favorite business book and why?
Yeah, this is, look, I have recency bias on this. So you can see it. I was reading it this morning, but Charlie Munger obviously just passed. So his almanac is really, really good. And I'm knee deep in that right now.
That's great. You're the second person who's recommended him. And I'm putting it on, I'm going to buy it and put it on my stack by my bed. Third question, who's your favorite influencer? So this is someone that's actually coming out with interesting ideas that you spend the time to read either the email or you follow him on LinkedIn, like who he or she, which one do you like most?
Well, yeah, I'll say there's a lot of very loud influencers that I don't think have a lot going on up here. And there's a lot of people with a lot going on up here that are very bad influencers. They don't know how to get attention. So my answer is going to be someone that I think does both. I think Jamin Ball is very good. Altimeter Capital on Twitter. He summarizes publicly traded SaaS calls and very easy to understand format. And I think he's one of those rare combinations of very intelligent. He also knows how to package his intelligence and his feedback in a way that is easily to consume.
Sorry, can you spell his last name for everybody?
Ball, like a bouncing ball, B-A-L-L. Ball.
And which firm is he with?
Altimeter Capital.
Altimeter Capital. I don't know him. I will add him to the list. Well, Nathan, as always, I learned something every time we chat. Enjoy your perspective. Congratulations to your success. And thanks so much for being part of SaaS Expert Voices.
Thank you, Randy.